to evaluate it, and it starts off, identify the major obstacles for the American westward expansion. And of course, Native people, Indian people. So, I mean, the tasks of education are multiple. And but I'm not even too sure if that is the sole answer or the answer. Now I just you know like to at least summarize what I have heard Native people saying, or what we've been discussing here in this roundtable and in previous roundtables, and that is the question that we're all grappling with is, and that is, how are Indigenous people going to survive culturally? And then now we're hearing, how are we going to survive with some measure of political autonomy? And clearly, Indigenous people are expressing this all over the world. If we can take, if we can accept what we have heard from the various participants at this meeting and previous meetings. Well, it seems that if this is going to be a reality, or is something that we're going to move towards, then some of the things we're going to have to do are look at the laws that currently affect Indigenous people. And it seems that we're going to have to be altering many of those laws if, in fact, Native people are going to be allowed to perpetuate their societies, which in most instances translates to land. How are we going to protect Native people's land? Okay, how are Native people going to do that? How are they going to amend laws? How are they going to affect changes? Clearly they lack the numerical numbers, and they lack the economic powers to change laws. We don't have the pipeline today to act as a leverage in amending ANCSA. And so it seems that we must begin to develop strategies to utilize other means, and it's means to persuade non-Native people to support the claims that Sheldon has talked about, the right to cultural survival, the right to political autonomy. And so where are we again? We're back to ideologies, ethics, and morality. We're back to Lacasa's debates. And I mean, maybe we've made some progress, I don't know. But those, I guess, are the tasks, some of the issues again, and again, I'm still left with questions.
Well, I think in the nature of things, we're bound to be left with questions. Might I just suggest that we proceed in the following way? Dessa, you wanted to say something, and I said earlier I would arrange that, and maybe you could go next. And David, you wanted to say something. All right, David, and then Dessa, and then Paul Goodwin, you wanted to say a few words. And then I'd like to come to Gard and Moani, if that's all right, and Verna. And we've still got a little bit of time. If you don't mind, let's just stop for 5 minutes for a cup of coffee. Do you mind that?
Just a few yards from those who'd like to add something. David, we were calling on you first. Okay. 15 seconds.
Good one, and Dessa, and Gard, and Verna, and Paul Goodwin. So, David, you start off then.
I just had a couple of Oren ask a question as to whether the Claims Act had done anything specific about education, and my first reaction to that was no. But then after Rosita got done, I realized the answer was yes. Claims Act, one of the earlier versions of the bill of the Claims Act, the bill that passed in 1970, in fact, passed the Senate, would have terminated education BIA, educational programs, in Alaska within 5 years. And that that particular feature of termination was eliminated from the final bill that passed in favor of a provision to study programs that were provided to Native Americans and then do something about them implicitly in the future. And I'll get back to that point as to what's happened with those programs a bit. But the Claims Act itself didn't do anything about education except, of course, mandate an institution which people would become either formally or informally, and I think it's been the latter, educated about, and that's the corporation. And in the I think it's worth reflecting on the kind of values that are probably educated into Native shareholders by the fact that for the last 14 years they have participated in a corporation which focuses on the assets of the corporation and the stock in the corporation as an individual asset. And I think that has been a terrifically significant process of education, probably. And probably not for the best in some views. Second, as to the effect that the Claims Act or events subsequent to it have had on education, and I think this really reflects something that is a problem in Alaska and an anomaly or incongruity, is that originally the Alaska state education system was highly centralized, and indeed the whole state structure of administration, and it's bizarre to me in a state this size and this diverse that it has one of the most centralized forms of executive government in the country, and that's conscious in the U.S. in the Alaska Constitution. And so much so that the Alaska Education Department was in rural Alaska was controlled from the one Anchorage office for years, and finally that was decentralized into a series of rural education attendance areas. But that isn't, I mean, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that. What has been significant to me is that the BIA schools in the late 70s were also transformed, and became possible for local communities to contract for the administration of the BIA Indian school. And what you found for a few brief years was that Native communities for the first time were really making their own curriculum decisions and hiring and firing decisions, and I think that was very significant. And now, of course, the product of the study, or maybe it's just the federal cutback, has resulted in the closing of the BIA schools. And the last contract schools are supposedly, and no one ever knows how this will turn out, but are supposedly to be closed. I think it's effective this year, at the end of this academic school year. And so you have a system of education that seems to me to be partially decentralized, but I think it's fair to say that there is some dissatisfaction with the amount of control that people have in the villages over the local schools. And that, I think, translates into questions of what can local people do in villages to affect the curriculum and what their children are taught. Because it might be better if the curriculum is controlled from a Bethel or Barrow than if it were controlled from Juneau. But Rosita, I think, indicated from the fact that there is a central statewide curriculum that there are problems with that. And that decentralization even further might be one avenue to pursue. Thank you.
Well, I think just so we can maintain the discussion in an orderly way, Paul Goodwin, who has been on previous roundtables when he was holding the position that Vernita Zillis has now. And is, Paul is now with the State Department of Education, and Paul, please carry on with this discussion, if you wish. What is your new post? Forgive me.
My new post is technically it's a special assistant to the Commissioner of Education, but I'm the coordinator for rural and Native education for the state of Alaska. What that means is I am kind of a politician, essentially. I get to work on some of the political issues that plague the state, and in particular, relative to this business of the BIA schools and also the 638 contract schools being closed, that's true that on June 30th of this year, that will be the end of BIA education activities in the state of Alaska. All schools in the state will then be in the REAAs, the Rural Education Attendance Areas. And there are five remaining communities that have 638 contract schools, five communities that have BIA-operated schools. So now the difference here is that the 638 schools are the best, in the best sense of the word, they are under local control. They are totally controlled by that individual community with really no outside influence. That is, that ability to do that was a result of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act that allowed a local community to contract for services that the BIA would normally provide. That anyway, the budget problems in the United States has forced the closure of those things, those schools, or that kind of activity, and so as a result, these communities, particularly the 638 communities, are having trouble coming into the REAA system. Now, the REAA system was designed originally to provide for local control. It was the state at one time did have a very centralized operation. The REAA legislation tried to accommodate the concept of local control so that you would have districts that didn't have too many villages in it, and then that district would presumably be culturally cohesive and so on and so forth, so that the district board then could actually put in place curriculum and so forth that was meaningful for that area and for that community. The problem that I'm currently working on is this, again, this business of transferring in the 638 schools into the state REAA system. That's a lot of times not very fun because there really is a loss of local control in this case. A community who has essentially absolute control over what it is, what goes on in their schools on one day, the next day they won't. Rather, a board that sits in Bethel will be determining the education of the children, on July 1st. that is a very much a difficulty for those communities. And I'm trying to work with the communities.
You say a board in Bethel for all of those 59 villages in the...
Well, the REAA boundaries are not, don't go according to, like, Calista boundaries.
Right.
They're smaller than that. You know, in the case of Lower Kuskokwim School District, or LKSD, there will be in that district when these schools transfer 28 villages or 28 communities that will be operated from Bethel educationally. Now, you know, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad, but the point is that even in a sub-region of Calista, which is the LKSD district, you still have, or you still can identify cultural variations. And then there's socio-cultural variations just because of Bethel. I mean, Bethel is not like Akiachuk. It is not like it at all, really. And Akiachuk is one of the villages that's going to have to come into the REAA fold. Working with the communities, I've tried to make some suggestions as to what they could do, like, for instance, lobby for the development of another REAA, which would effectively cut in half the LKSD region, so as that would provide more local control, because you would have an REAA that was more culturally cohesive and that would have less villages in it, you know, a coastal REAA as an example. What finally came out of all of this anyway was Sackett and Ferguson introduced a bill that would establish an REAA around each one of those 638 communities, so in other words, five more REAAs. I have some questions as to whether that's going to get by the legislature, given the revenue shortfalls of the state this year, but that would again gain them that absolute local control, and that's one way to do it. The only problem is it's kind of expensive way to do it. You know, but that would be a way to accommodate complete local control. The model curriculum that was being talked about here is on track. It's being developed. But we do need to have an integrated, cohesive educational system in the state. We need to have bottom lines if we're going to have an educational system. That's very much implied in the Constitution of the state. And some of the problems, though, that I have had in the Department of Education with regard to just the philosophy of education, if you will, is that, you know, I came from Kotzebue originally, and I was culturally an Eskimo. And I look at myself now, after this educational process that I subjected myself to, which was a PhD in physics, and I wonder, you know, am I the same person as I was back then when I was 5 years old, as an example? Am I still as native now as I am was then? Well, I can feel certain really deep responses in myself to this day. It's like, as an example, we had a UTA meeting in Sitka, and one of the UTA people, Teresa Peoples, who is now Teresa Ricketts, and I got up to dance, and the band was a particularly good beat, and it was a beat that was very similar to what you hear in the Eskimo dances. Well, Teresa and I were Eskimo dancing because that's something that just comes out of me naturally when I hear that beat. So I'm Eskimo to the degree that I retain those real deep environmental things, but I am not the same anymore. The fact is that education changes people objectively. If you go into a traditional community and seek to educate the children of that community, you have changed them objectively, physically. You have actually changed them. Sixten Harrelson gave a paper here in Anchorage that said if you want to retain the traditionality of a culture and you still want to provide education to that culture, to the people of that culture, then you'd better not educate them beyond the sixth grade. Because if you do, you've just essentially removed them from their traditional culture. Now, that this can be explained by some of the new findings in brain research, is that there really is an objective difference in your brain, in the wiring of your brain, after you've been exposed to the formal educational process. At one time, it's been known for quite a while that the formal educational process changes certain cognitive skills, and that's obvious. You increase your ability to classify, you increase your ability for abstract thought, you increase your abilities in articulation. Those have been known for a long time. And might add, those are the three major components of the IQ tests. So you are influencing in that. It has been recently learned, however, that when you subject an organism, whether it's a human or any neurological organism, when you subject an organism to a different environment from the one that they are used to, let's say, or growing up in, you can affect the wiring of their brain. And indeed, people, when they are exposed to a different influence, like, for instance, an educational influence, lots of mathematics courses as an example, while they are young, while they are in the so-called arborization phase, they will grow new wires for you. They will be actually different, physically actually different. The Aplysia theory of learning also indicates that there are biochemical differences that are realized in the brain when a person learns. The reason I bring all of this stuff up is that it's kind of a heavy number. You know, you have cultures in transition, and you want to have them remain the same. You don't want them to change so fast. You want to provide the good stuff for them, like education. I mean, those are the people that I came from out there. I want them to have education, but by virtue of wanting them to have education, the better education that I deliver in the mathematics, you know, reading and writing sense, the more I'm changing the culture that I wanted to protect. It's a real dilemma. But on the other hand, I justify that on the basis that cultures are in transition, and that's it. They are. I don't see that there's any way of maintaining the status quo with the world population and with population in the United States. I can't see that it would remain the same, or even is it desirable that these cultures remain the same? Is that desirable, to have a static, completely traditional, non-moving culture? I don't know that that's particularly good. But education, anyway, does change people, and it changes culture. It's part of the transition process, and either fortunately or unfortunately, as the case may be, and depending on how you look at it, the education accelerates that process. It's one of the most accelerating processes there is. The only thing I can think of that would have an influence of a similar nature would be television in all those communities, because that puts a whole different aspect on the community. I remember going into a lot of those communities a year after, you know, television was there. Before, and I've been there before, and I was there after, and to note the behavioral difference in the people is it was amazing to me. It was absolutely amazing to see that behavioral difference. That's pretty much all I wanted to say about on the philosophical end of things, but I do have one other thing that perhaps this round table would be interested in as far as programs are concerned in the Department of Education. One of the things that we did get before I came on board at DOE was some money from the legislature to produce two key things that I think, that, you know, I've heard this from the people in rural Alaska time and time again that they really would like to have, and that's one, as we're producing some ANCSA-related material, and we're doing a cultures program. Now, the way that we finally settled on doing this anyway is this is a group of six videos with support curriculum material for the target audience of kids, whether rural or urban, of grades 10 through 12, that explains ANCSA in a civics-like sort of a way. Okay, the first block of programs is going to be just a hardcore civics type of a thing. The cultural program we're going to tie into ANCSA, that will be ANCSA and 638 will be the theme of those 10 videos, and it will show cultures and what law does to culture, what law does to people. And so it will take the hardcore ANCSA curriculum, you know, like you might learn in a pre-law class or something like that, that kind of curriculum, and it will follow it into a more cultural orientation or social orientation now. So I think it sounds really good if the contractors can pull it off. It's kind of a very demanding sort of a thing to ask somebody to do, but it's a good idea if they can pull it off. I'll be interested in seeing if they can. But we have a lot of really talented people in the state of Alaska. I'm sure somebody can. And that's that. About all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Verna, would you like to carry on the discussion from there?
Thank you, Tom. I was interested in hearing Paul's comments here. I'll begin with the comment that he made about learning and what happens after grade six. And, you know, what I understand him to say about the fact that, you know, we change so much. And I think regardless of who we are and what we do and how we learn, change is just a matter of course, and that it will happen. I'm always a little worried about people that, you know, will draw conclusions such as that. I mean, there are, you know, there's a lot of research right now going on, or I shouldn't say a lot, some research on, for example, right brain, left brain theories or research about Indian people, and they try to tell us that we're really right brain learners, and the school system really gives you a left brain kind of learning. My answer to that is, no wonder there's a lot of half-brained white people. No, sorry. No, I didn't mean to say that. I was going to keep this clean. But, you know, I think we always have to be so careful to seek the evidence, and a lot of evidence in any matters like this, because I would feel really, really terrible to believe that, you know, we would change drastically in ourselves, in who we are as Native people. And I just say that the only thing I want to say is a caution that we don't do that we really seek the evidence a lot more. And the comment that he made on local control of education, I'm really sorry to hear that they're moving into the other kinds of schools. I think it's a backward step from the contract schools, because what I wanted to state myself in all of this discussion about education is that I think the only answer to education for ourselves is that we have to own our own education. We really have to own our own education. We have to stand up to all the education systems that are prevailing upon us to have us, you know, accommodate us in that particular way. I really feel that the only direction to go, to come out even, is to own our own education, and that is the position we've taken in Canada. And I just want to speak briefly to what we're doing in Canada, not to say that everything is working perfectly, but these are sort of the things that we're working towards. In 1972, we established a policy of Indian control of Indian education. And this policy was established by the Indian people of Canada. And it's a policy where we lay out our own philosophy and our directions and goals in Indian education. In fact, we had the policy accepted by the federal government in 1973 and had an agreement that they would implement the proposals that we had in our policy statement. And some of the underlying philosophical statements is this. One of the things we believe that education for our people must do three things. It must foster pride in ourselves, pride in oneself, understanding of our fellow man, and living in harmony with nature. You know, I hope that you'll just pick out from there, you know, the significant things to yourselves, because whenever we talk about owning our own education, we're so much criticized for trying to be separate, but maybe that's the only way that we can survive and have our place in this world. And we want education, this is stated in our policy statement, to prepare us for total living, to enable us to have a free choice of where to live and work. I think that's critical too. To enable us to participate fully in our own social, political, economical, and educational development. So all I'm talking about is ownership, our owning our lives, owning our directions. This Indian control of Indian education policy of ours is based on two principles that are really recognized in Canadian society. And one of those is parental responsibility and local control. You know, like we were talking here about local control. We can't have control from Ottawa and control from the regional offices or control from Bethel and expect something really important to happen. It has to be local and it has to be parental responsibility. Education in our country, we see it as part of the self-government process. And the way it happens for us is that the Minister of the Department of Indian Affairs, through a contribution agreement, provides monies to our Indian bands to administer our own education systems. Indian bands, in turn, can designate their own education authority, and often that's elected or appointed school boards that they have. Another statement, we talk about curriculum a lot, and I'm so tired of the patchwork we're doing. You know, we're taking the provincial curriculum and we're always attempting to try to patch it up so that it can relate to us in a certain way. I think the fundamental thing underlying all the curriculum that is in our school is this, and this is, I was trying to remember from our policy statement since I didn't bring it with me, states this: unless a child learns about the forces which shape him, his history, his culture, his language, customs, he will never really know himself or his potential as a human being. What he learns must be rooted in his culture, and learning must reflect the values of our own people. And some of the values, you know, independence and self-reliance. I was listening to Rosita when she mentioned that you're looking at the curriculum here in your in this state or, you know, in Alaska. And we've done a lot of that too, and, you know, tried to put in more appropriate social studies and that. And I think that, in a sense, maybe I sound like I'm contradicting myself, and I say, you know, there is a lot of work to be done there, because there the kinds of materials that are being used right now for Native and non-Native people really are wrong. Just we took a look at the social studies book in Manitoba, and we found just many, many gross errors in the whole thing. And just recently, in trying to correct this in British Columbia, they commissioned or contracted a publishing company to put out books. And they did one on the explorers. I wish I had it here with me. And, you know, because we're saying it really wasn't the these explorers that really found these places, but the Indian people. So they were trying to reflect that a little more. I had an opportunity to read some of these books, and I thought this one was rather strange. I might just relate it to you about Anthony Hendy. I don't know if you know the great Anthony Hendy, and I think it's the Hudson Bay. I don't know myself. No. Anyway, he apparently, as many did, had an Indian wife. And so the author decided a good way to really show this is to have Grey Goose Woman, who is Anthony Hendy's Indian wife, to tell her story of her life with this great Anthony Hendy. And so the story goes, you know, I mean, she's talking about how wonderful he is, and it really griped me from two aspects. One, from the woman aspect and how they had her worshiping Anthony Hendy. And from the Indian aspect, because if any of you have ever gone in a canoe in the rough waters, there is absolutely no darn way that an Indian woman can be beating a jacket for Anthony Hendy, you know. And that was the way they, you know, portrayed it, you know, doing these great, wonderful things. Anyway, that's just an example of the kinds of things that go on. And I think there are things that can be done with our materials. For example, commercial time, it'd be better to buy my book on Indians of the Plains. Grolier of Canada, 1984. No, actually, no, what I'm trying to say is this. I really do believe, though, if we're going to learn social studies and that, we have to be authors also of the textual materials. You know, if you look at the kinds of textbooks that are out now, they're all quoting each other, you know, all the things that happen from the secondary sources. And I think we have to try to write truer social studies and readers and what have you. Anyway, I don't want to take too much time, but let me just say back to the policy. We also made a statement about teachers and counselors, that we need more Native teachers and counselors who are trained, because we know that they know the culture of the people and they'll have high expectations of the children, will be role models. These are some things we've been hearing in passing here. Teachers will teach from the known to the unknown and build on the foundation and not beside it, and so on and so forth, you know. Non-Native teachers and counselors have to learn about our culture and beliefs and so on, and we need to stabilize the teaching force. So there are a lot of things that we could say about the policy, and it's been in existence for over a decade, and I just recently wrote a paper myself called Indian Control of Indian Education Over a Decade Later. And I point out some of the, you know, larger problems within that, but not to dwell on the problems, I want to say that it really is the only way to go. I'm convinced that Indian controlled schools is what we have to do. We have to own our own schools. Our objective, of course, in these schools is to provide a quality education for our people. You know, it's so hard to explain that, like that we want what you want for your children. I mean, other people want for their children. We want the same kind of thing. We want quality education and meaningful education for our people. So parents can have to be involved in this kind of a situation. You know, when we talk about who will design the Indian education, well, our people will design it, and our people can design it and have been doing it. The elders have a great part to play in these schools. And, you know, what you would see, let me just describe what I think is a really fine Indian-controlled school or an Indian school, is if you walk into the school and you know you're in an Indian school because you have pictures, you have things that reflect Indian life. You know, you don't have the lion and the alligator for your ABCs, you know. But you have Aleuts, no, Alaskans, No, you have things that are relevant to our own people. You would have in there, you would have children singing Indian songs, doing Indian dancing. I just saw that the other day. You know, I really feel that in December and January, I visited a lot of these schools that I'm talking about, because I've been one of the people that have really advocated Indian control of Indian education in our province and in our country. And I was really pleased to go into these schools, because you should see the pride in those children's faces when they're showing you they're singing and they're dancing. You know, I mean, we all respect the Mexican hat dance, and oh no, those are our friends and neighbors. No, those kinds of folk dances, but why not our own dances in the schools too? And they read stories about and poetry about Native people. This science area, there are many things that Native people have contributed in science. Things about our own government and our traditional way of governing. You see all kinds of things going on. You see foremost Indian people in the schools. You see elders in there helping in the schools. You know, I don't want to leave you with the impression that we just sing and dance and do beadwork, which is what often happens. Not at all. But so a lot of that can be added into the curriculum. And there are many ways that you can work in math, as I say, science, health. There are so many things that we could talk about in that as well. And when you see this happening only as a basis of operating from the known to the unknown, that's the connection we're trying to make, you know, because that's a cliche in the education world, in moving from the unknown, the known to the unknown. And yet for years we've been subjected to unknown to unknown, and you're not really building on the foundation, and you're not involving your people in the whole process. So there's beautiful poetry by our own people. There's lovely stories, all kinds of things that we can do. When you teach reading, for example, you're teaching reading. You should have material that's familiar to yourselves, to the people in your community when you're doing that. And yet I taught for many years using a book called Streets and Roads, which was mostly streets in northern Manitoba, where the only way you could get there was by airplane, you know? Just about as bad as that. You try and teach a child what an elevator is, you know, in the silly monkeys going up and down in the elevator. You try to explain that. And so you're using foreign concepts to try and teach a subject, oftentimes in a foreign language. So anyway, to conclude this, I'd like to say that some of the results already of 10 years of Indian control of Indian education in some of our schools really shows an improvement in attendance. People always say people are dropping out at grade 8 and 9, and you see a difference here. People are staying in longer. Indian control schools see it as total education. Most of them have adults in the schools that are also learning. And it goes right from play school right up to that type of a situation. And the attendance in some places have gone from 50% to almost 100%. The attendance has gone up, the people are retained in the schools, the grades are improving, the parental involvement, which is critical, I think, to the whole education process, is there. And then, you know, that I guess the proof for us, and just to make the connection that I firmly believe, as many of our people do, that we need to get into post-secondary education. And there again, you know, we are working on in those institutions. In fact, I think in Canada, it's admirable that there is an Indian-controlled university or college in Saskatchewan, where, you know, they can work within their own culture as well. But anyway, yesterday when Robert Goldwyn, I don't know if he's turned me off or not, he's wanted to know about some of the... But you know, you're the one yesterday that was asking what kinds of ways in education are there some principles or some you know, some elements that maybe could lead in the direction of this. And perhaps this is not terribly new to a lot of people, but I knew that eventually this whole round table would try to look to education for some of the answers. And I don't think they're terribly, they're all attainable, And I've been trying to, I guess, illustrate here how within the 21st century, you know, we can have a meaningful kind of education. And there isn't the time to deal with the more specific areas which we are really trying to begin to deal with. And we have done a lot of work in curriculum ourselves, you know, based on our languages and all kinds of work, because it's difficult to have to change a system and move back, you know, into the kind of learning that is meaningful today. So anyway, I'm sure that Mr. Berger didn't intend me to talk so long, but I did make a few notes yesterday on that item when you were asking.
Well, thanks very much, Verna. I think we all appreciate your description of some very real successes that have occurred in where we come from in Canada, and for which Verna, I should say, is in many ways largely responsible. That won't come as any surprise to you, having heard her. Gard, and then Dessa, and then Robert Goldwyn, and then me.
I share your enthusiasm, Verna, and appreciate your presentation that you've just made. I too wonder what kind of results would have happened if some body chemistry tests were given to our ancestors after devising such intricate ways of recording the environment that they lived in so well. I think it was, I get a little bit annoyed at left brain, right brain kind of stories, because I think they sometimes tend to stereotype cultures in ways that are, they're skewed. They have absolutely no relation to what really happened. At least that's my own point of view. I happen to be the culture education chair for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and also serve on the President's Advisory Board of the Kamehameha Schools. Yesterday I talked about the last princess of the Kamehameha dynasty, who left all of her estate to the revenues to support a school for Hawaiian children. That was done almost 100 years ago. And I wanted to talk briefly on the schools, go into a little bit of OHA, and I think we have a little bit of different attitude. There's a little twist that's maybe a little bit different, maybe not, depends how you look at it. And then as you were all talking, I was thinking back, and the last queen, Liliuokalani and Kalakaua, the last king, were very interested in education. The Native Hawaiians, of course, started the public schools. I talked about the fact that when the missionaries developed a language, the Hawaiian